107.3.
Hello and welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. It is time for Final Draft. You are tuned into 2ACR 107.3. And Final Draft is books, writing, and literary culture every week, Australian literature. In your ears, on your radio, in your earbuds, wherever you're listening to me. I never have enough time to talk books, but today I'm going to make the most of every second that I can because I have got two fantastic books, two fantastic interviews with authors to present today. Before we get started, of course, I want to acknowledge that 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I am recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gundungurra people in the Blue Mountains outside of Sydney. I want to pay my respects to the traditional owners of those lands. I want to pay my respects to their ongoing connection to those lands and acknowledge that treaty was never reached in Australia. These are unceded lands, stolen lands. Look, starting off the show, I've got a fantastic new own voices narrative, YA novel, young adult novel from Rebecca Lim. Rebecca is an author of so much incredible, like more than 20 incredible young adult novels that span fantasy and like sort of speculative fiction. But today we have got her latest. It is called Tiger Daughter, and it is a fascinating and really kind of heart-wrenching story of I guess the experience of migration and being a first generation child in Australia, going through high school and trying to be a part of that world. I am also today going to be joined. Let me just do this in the right order. Were you noticing earlier this week, Victorian Premier's Literary Awards, the richest literary awards in Australia? Well, they announced their winners. It included the People's Choice Award, which was Witness by Louise Milligan. Unpublished Manuscript was Anam by Andre Dow. The prize for Indigenous writing was Tell Me Why, The Story of My Life and Music by Archie Roach. Young adult writing went to Metalfish Falling Snow. The prize for poetry was Case Notes by David Stavanger. The prize for drama was Wanangatta by Angus Chirini. The prize for nonfiction, Body Count, How Climate Change is Killing Us from Paddy Manning. But the winner, the person I'm going to be speaking to today of the prize for fiction and the overall Victorian prize for literature is Laura Jean McKay for The Animals in That Country. Laura's going to be joining me to talk about her win and talk about her stunning, speculative, apocalyptic novel, The Animals in That Country. So that's two books to discover today, two books to listen back to on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Join me as I was speaking with Rebecca Lim and Laura Jean McKay. It is coming up just after this very short break.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture. Now, my name is Andrew Popel, and today I am joined by Rebecca Lim. She is the author of more than 20 books. She's an author, a lawyer, an illustrator. She's an editor. Her work, including The Astrologer's Daughter and The Mercy Series, has been listed for the PM's Literary Awards, the Indies and Aurealis Awards. Rebecca has a new book out, and today she's joining me. We're going to be discussing Tiger Daughter. Rebecca, thank you so much. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Really, really happy to be here.
Now, I'd be remiss to not sort of mention the hashtag LoveOzYA because you have got this is a fantastic book for young adults. Wern and Henry, they're friends, they're drawn together as the children of refugees, as well as by shared dreams of escaping their suburban school. Wern loves to read and draw, but her father, he sees these things as frivolous pursuits. So Wern and Henry, they're dreaming of sitting the selective schools exam. They want to escape to a high school that's going to nurture their talents and offer them something beyond. We talked off air. This book made me cry. This book made me smile. It is fantastic. I want to start off though, because you deal with so many incredible issues that are so important to all of our lives, and like so much YA, it's because it's got a young protagonist. It's not because not everyone should be reading it. And I want to put a content warning on, because we will be moving into areas we'll be discussing things like mental health, and also mention that if this brings up anything for the listener, that they can call Lifeline on 131114. Lifeline have been such an amazing resource for people for many years, and particularly, I guess, over this period that we've had been dealing with COVID and lockdown. So, look, if this conversation brings up anything for you, know that Lifeline are there. Rebecca, Juan and Henry, they're both the children of refugees, and this identity, it's drilled into them at school, whether they want it or not. I feel like that's probably going to be a little uncomfortable for many listeners who may have found themselves on the receiving end, or perhaps, if they're willing to acknowledge it themselves, perhaps on the bullying side of that. At home, they're made to feel that situation, though, in a different way. One's father's bitterness at failing his medical specialist exam, it leaves him aloof and often abusive with his family. He's very angry and very shouty. Australia, it's a country that seems almost gleefully ignorant at times of the lives, the struggles, and the poor treatment of non-white migrants. Did you want to highlight these issues as part of the lives of everyday Australians?
I did, actually. Just to clarify, they're actually first-generation migrants, economic migrants rather than refugees, but I'm hoping that the book speaks to first-generation and second-generation children who are either migrant or refugee, because it does speak about an Australian kind of story that we don't often see in published literature for children and young adults. Often we'll get, you know, the issues book that sort of talks about, you know, the very well-off person who has to choose between two hot boyfriends, or we'll get, you know, very mainstream narratives. And I guess I wrote the book actually out of a sense of rage, because I remember going to my daughter's Year 7, English parent-teacher interview, and they said, we've done a tailored book list for your daughter. Here's a book list, have a read. And so on the book list was books like, you know, Playing BC Bow, Picnic at Hanging Rock, Forgetting of Wisdom. And I went to the same school over 30 years ago, and I remember when I was in Year 7, those were exactly the same books I read. And so in 30 years, nothing had changed in relation to what we were teaching our children. And my daughter is at a school which is over 50% Asian or South Asian. So for them to be getting the same book list I was getting, you know, three decades ago is a pretty sad indictment of where our publishing sort of gone. It hasn't moved that quickly. I think in the 1950s in America, educators were already saying, are our books too white for children? And they still are. So for me, it was a really personal thing. I have a daughter in primary school and a daughter in high school, and they are still not seeing their own lives reflected in the books that they're being given and studying. So that's kind of where that came from. I'm a first-generation person. It's taken me years to process, you know, the kinds of casual racism and other racism I've dealt with over my life. My daughters don't get it so badly now, obviously, because they are sort of, you know, there's more of them at school, basically. But it's speaking to those kids who have to walk in those two universes of, you know, the kind of white mainstream affluent world that they have to navigate, and then the kind of home and cultural and traditional things that they have to navigate in the private sphere. So it's kind of trying to deal with a few things at once.
I feel like there's this idea around narrative. People like to talk about the universality of a narrative, and that's almost like a golden egg of storytelling, that somehow a story will relate to everyone. But I want to interrogate that a little bit. Now, you're a co-founder of Voices from the Intersection. It's an initiative to support emerging YA and children's authors and illustrators who are First Nations, people of colour, LGBTIQA+, or authors living with a disability. Can you talk to me a little bit about intersectionality? What is it, and why is it so important to approach a story like Juan's with an understanding of the various pressures that she has on her life because of the multiple identities that she carries?
Yeah. So with intersectionality, which is, I think, a term that was coined in the 1980s by a legal academic in America who's African-American, essentially some people will be sort of subject to multiple systems of, I guess, discrimination. So if you're female and you're refugee, or you're female and you're LGBT, you're standing at an intersection of where for example, you're subject to sexism and you're also subject to, gender discrimination or racial discrimination. So intersectionality is something that can affect certain readers and writers because they aren't from the dominant narrative. They're not, male, straight, white. So to assume that a story that's written by a male, straight, white person will necessarily speak to them is a bit of a sort of unnuanced mistake, I suppose. So intersectionality is important because you'll see that, nowadays kids are sort of turning away from books, for example, and going on to manga or, slam poetry or rap or other things that speak to their lived experience. And that's because I think a lot of the books that we publish, they still just speak to that dominant voice and they don't recognise that, a gay black woman in America wouldn't necessarily want to read about, the sexual tribulations of a white male author. It's that kind of recognition of we're trying to speak to everyone alive rather than we're just trying to speak to this very kind of specific, market that we've always been publishing for and that we've always been marketing to. But that's kind of wrong in this day and age because I think people like me, for example, I've been here over 40 years now. We're actually trying to agitate for, a wider understanding of what an Australian person is and also a wider understanding of what an Australian story is because you'll get your children to read if they can see themselves reflected in the stories that they're given.
You begin in a remedial English class. Juan doesn't need this class. She's attending because she's there to help Henry. And I felt like in this class, you show us a glimpse of the forces driving the world that you're building for Juan and for Henry. Communication is, I thought, the key in the world of Tiger Daughter. Juan must negotiate the dynamics of who gets to communicate, what they say or what is said, the clarity of their message and who is listened to. She experiences this at school. She particularly experiences this at home and how she gets to have a say in her life. So how does communication work in a world that must navigate not only these differences in languages, but also those generations and power dynamics?
Communication is super important. And I guess there's a real sort of patriarchal drive, I guess, for schools when they're trying to sort of bring migrant and refugee children up to scratch, so to speak. There's often, before school kind of classes, which are trying to like drag them up to the standard of so-called normal students. And so, I really wanted to show that, apart from, the normal school day that most children will experience, there's all these other children who are desperately trying to catch up and, become like them and stand on a level playing field with other people just so that they can get through their day. And so I wanted to show with Wynne going to the class for people like Henry and other recent, arrivals to Australia, I wanted to show the different levels that you can possibly get in a migrant child. So, when they come, they have no kind of, they've got no way to sort of navigate things. But, the longer they're here and the more they pick up and the more interested they are in actually understanding power structures, for example, they become more and more fluent in the language that, everybody else is speaking. And so for me, for example, when I came, I didn't speak English. And so it took me years to work out, why is that teacher giving us apples and milk at this time of the day? Why do people get dragged off home when they wet their pants, for example? So you're looking at all this stuff happening visually and trying to work out exactly what the teacher's doing and, why are things structured this way? And so I started the novel off with that feeling of once you become more fluent in the dominant language, it helps you navigate that external sphere of your life much more easily than you could have done before. But that fluency in the outside world doesn't necessarily translate to the private sphere that you live in because maybe your parents aren't interested in what's happening at school. They're not interested in you getting, different opinions from them. They're not interested in learning about, what the dominant narrative is because they've got their own concerns. They're trying to put food on the table. They're trying to, deal with their network. It's that kind of, interrogation of, I guess, relative fluency. You only gain power in this society if you are fluent in the language that people speak in. And for me, that's been a very personal journey too. I quite deliberately did law because, one, I'm interested in language. And two, it's that I want to understand how stuff works. I want to know why people contract. I want to know why government works this way and why people talk to each other this way and why did documents look like this. And I could not have done that if I'd been, a doctor, for example, which was the way I was being pushed, as every other migrant Chinese kid is being pushed. in that direction.
I saw in that realization of one's father's character, maybe something that seems to be, you know, writ globally amongst powerful people or people who follow powerful people, this idea that they want to stay in, as you mentioned there, an older fashioned, very unmovable idea of how things are, whether that's a literal interpretation of a book or a very narrow interpretation of an ideology, and then sticking there and then just shutting out all other argument. And that idea of shutting out one is very open in her life, and she wants to open it up even further. But within her house, it feels like the smaller that world can become, the more comfortable her father is, insofar as he's not very comfortable at all. And maybe we need to talk a little bit more about that. He is such a dominant figure in her life. And that role of parents and parenting looms large in our understanding of Wan's life and her dreams. Now, I feel like I've picked up on this correctly, that your title plays on the idea of tiger parenting, which was a term that was popularized back in 2011 with...
when the Amy Tribe book came out,
Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And, I mean, anyone, quick Google search of that term, you will find that that is not uncontested ground. That idea is still getting a lot of debate. And the term tiger mother, it evokes some stereotyped and really racialized ideas around parenting styles that I think you were trying to problematize in Tiger Daughter. Your title also highlights that your protagonist, Wen, it's foreshadowing a strength that she doesn't know she has at the book's opening. What did you want the title, though, to communicate to those potential readers?
I think what I was trying to say was, you know, the idea of tiger parents is such a negative thing. And so I guess in the Western press, it's like, look how Asian parents do it. That's amazing. How could they force their children to do those things, right? So it's got a real, negative cultural stereotype to it. And, you know, I'm fully the product of tiger parenting, so I completely understand it from inside out. And deliberately with my own children, I have a son and two daughters. I think I'm a little bit too lax. And I often laugh with my, you know, Chinese Australian friends, oh my God, so failing as a tiger parent, because I don't make them do anything. I keep telling them, for God's sake, drop that instrument. You are hopeless. You're not practicing. Like, why are you doing it for? None of us are forcing you to do it. So I think I've gone the other way and just become a little bit too slack about their schooling and other things. But I was trying to reclaim that terminology because, you know, the people who come out of a tiger parenting situation, the children who survive that, they either break into pieces and completely, you know, like go off the rails, or they come out sort of like, I like to say, they come out a harder, faster, meaner, you know, kind of brighter version of themselves, because they've had to survive all this crap that's thrown at them constantly, all these standards, you know, all these hours of practice, all these things you're expected to do. You know, like for me, for example, I'm not a boy, but, you know, fully expected to be a good Chinese wife and mother, but also fully expected to be, you know, top of my field, do well at school, do all these, you know, extra degrees, you know, do all that extra stuff, do those instruments, speak those languages. And, you know, like, how are you expected to survive the whole superstructure that's just thrust upon you as a kid? So I think with the title, I was quite deliberately saying, sure, tiger parenting can be bad and it's pretty negative, but the people who come out of that, who actually draw strength from that whole crazy experience, it gives them sort of like, I think, extra facets that potentially someone you don't push, you know, may not have, because they've not had to deal with pressure from a young age, and, you know, they'll never maybe be ready for that kind of level of pressure. But, you know, some of us come out and, you know, it's like you either come out as like someone who's been absolutely broken with a hammer, or you come out like a diamond, because you can deal with anything that's thrown your way. So that's kind of what I was trying to get to, I think.
And that's a really beautiful point for us to leave off there, because we are at the, you know, very early stages of 2021. We are talking about a young adult novel that everyone should read. Don't get me wrong, this is not just a book for young adults to read, but school's going back. This is something that can be shared and reshared. I'm speaking with Rebecca Lim, and we are discussing Tiger Daughter. If you've not mistaken me, dear listener, I loved this book and I would thoroughly recommend it. Rebecca, thank you so much for taking the time on Final Draft today.
Thank you so much. It's just been such a pleasure to talk with you about stuff that's sort of been sitting heavy on me for a long time. So it's great that people are sort of, you know, getting all the kinds of issues and layers that I've built in there, because I just want to talk to people about this stuff. And it's great that I finally got the chance to do that. So thank you.
You're listening to Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. Huge thank you again to Rebecca Lim for joining me to discuss her new YA novel, Tiger Daughter. Thank you also to Rebecca for taking that time to help unpack the idea of intersectional voices and what intersectionality is and how it impacts the stories that we read and the way we read those stories. I want to keep exploring these ideas because it is so important to our readership and to who we are, I think, as Australians, understanding that there is more than one simple force or identity that impacts ourselves and others. There is still more to come on the show today. Stay tuned. We are about to go into a strange apocalyptic wasteland where the animals are talking to us. That's right. I am about to be joined by Laura Jean McKay discussing her 2020 Victorian Premier's Literary Award winning The Animals in That Country.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3, FM, DAB, on demand, live stream and app.
This is 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft, it's books, writing and literary culture. Now, my name is Andrew Popel and I would like to introduce Laura Jean McKay. Laura is the author of Holiday in Cambodia. She's a lecturer in creative writing. She's the animal expert on ABC's Animal Sound Safari. But today, Laura is joining us because her latest work, The Animals in That Country, won the 2020 Victorian Premier's Literary Award. That is a big deal. It is the richest prize for literature in Australia. Laura, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. It is such a delight to be here and celebrate this with you.
I think it's worth noting, literary awards are a big deal, but I feel also regular readers might not keep too closely abreast. It's important to say that the Victorian Premier's Literary Award, it's made up of several awards, of which you won the big category as well as the category for like literature, for fiction. So that's huge. That's incredible.
It's such an amazing night. I've often attended the event in Melbourne and it's just held at a hot time of the year. It's always hot. People dress up. It's just a big hug fest. It's so beautiful to go there and support everyone, especially because it's that staged sort of prize. You know, there's a People's Choice Award, there's the category awards for fiction and nonfiction and poetry and unpublished manuscript. And then there's that big prize. So everyone is just holding their breath. And even though it was online this year, there was that same feeling. They really did a great job of creating that exciting atmosphere.
We're all, it's good to go to a Zoom where it's, you know, a big celebration and not just, you know, you've put on a business shirt but you're still wearing pyjamas underneath.
That's right, even though, you know, we might have all still been doing that.
Fine, we won't tell anyone.
It's just you and I talking, right?
Yeah, it's just the two of us. Now, you won for your novel, The Animals in That Country. I was reading a little bit of The Animals in That Country this morning. I was just getting prepped for our chat with my cats. They were sort of circling around me, asking for food, asking for belly rubs, or at least that's what I thought. Because your book has changed those interactions forever, I think. Because The Animals in That Country, it explores a pandemic sweeping across Australia that leaves the infected with mild cold symptoms, pink eyes, and the ability to hear and communicate with animals. The story, it takes us into a conservation reserve where Jean works as a guide, as much, I guess, from her love of animals as her love for her granddaughter, Kimberly. And initially, the reserve is free from zoo flu, as it's been called. But how long that quarantine can last? Now, when I mentioned the conceit of that animal-human communication to people, much like Kimberly, they're initially thrilled at the idea of hearing their pets' professions of love. Was it like that for you at first, this idea?
Actually, yes. I thought, wouldn't it be incredible if the language barrier was taken away? I'm constantly staring, especially at wild animals. And I was thinking, I'd love to know what's really going on for them, and to be able to sort of communicate my wonder at what they are to them as well. But once I started getting into the writing and the research for the novel, I realised or came to terms with maybe the fact that our relationship with other animals is very fraught. It's a very uneven power dynamic that we have. We're super apex predators in this world. It's a very violent relationship. Even with animals that we call part of our family, it's never really equal, even though we like to think that our cats have domination over us. Of course, they're in a very vulnerable position. They rely on us for a lot of things, including their safety.
As a work of literature, you are engaging widely with genre, but also literary works and philosophy. As a work of environmental criticism, but also colonization. But as Jean hits the road to rescue Kimberly, and I'm gonna just leave the tension there hanging for people to discover. But as Jean hits the road to rescue Kimberly, I noticed that despite the degradation of human society, that this was not all an absolute descent into anarchy. So many characters we meet seem to glory at the world of animals and this communication with animals. So did you have the sense that you were occupying a dystopian or a utopian space in the animals in that country?
Such a good question. I mean, I'm writing, it's an apocalyptic novel, really. You know, a lot of novels are post-apocalyptic and, you know, it's something terrible has happened and this is how we cope with the aftermath. But in this novel, you know, I wrote it in the first person and in that present tense very, very consciously so that we're right there in the moment when this is occurring. So in that way, I don't know whether it's dystopian or utopian. I mean, it's both, I hope. I guess most people reading it would judge it as a dystopia, but for some people in the novel and for some animals in the novel, this is a world that is bettered by this disease. There is some understanding, and just because the world as we know it is completely tipped upside down and everything that we know has, you know, gone to hell, is that such a bad thing? Is the world that we've created the best world? Do we need a bit of a shake up in order to, you know, to change things for the better? Having said that, as in every case, and as we see in this current climate, especially with coronavirus, it's the people who are already suffering who suffer the most from these huge world events. And, you know, in the novel, there are people who have taken to the streets and they're you know, doing sort of backyard surgery on themselves in an effort to try to get away from these animal voices. And in these situations, people become very desperate. And we're seeing that all over the world. There's a lot of people suffering at the moment, and it's not the rich people. So that's always the risk of imagining that you know, shaking the world up, or that these huge events will be ultimately better. Maybe they will be better for a lot of people, but for a lot it's just really, really hard.
I could not think of a more perfect note for us to end this conversation on, Laura. I'm speaking with Laura Jean McKay. Her novel, The Animals in That Country, has won the 2020 Victorian Premier's Literary Award. And you need to discover this book, dear listener. It is phenomenal. I mean, forget the award. The idea of talking animals is one that you need to discover and look at your own place in the world. Laura, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss this.
It's been such a delight to talk to you. Your questions are incredible and have really given my brain a run for its money. So thank you.
You are on Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel and I have just enough time to say goodbye and let you know, remind you that if you want to catch more of my conversations with Rebecca Lim today or Laura Jean McKay, tune in to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Full unedited conversations go up. You can discover all the bits that you missed, hear more about these incredible books. Thank you so much to Rebecca and to Laura. They were incredible guests. They have incredible works. I would recommend reading them, but I mean, I love reading so much. I'm going to be back next week. I've got so many incredible things. I'm going to be sharing a new one from JP Pomare. But till then, I'm Andrew Popel. This is Final Draft. Happy reading.